Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain of global finance and monetary control with one of the foremost experts in the field. Author of the bestseller Web of Debt and the Public Bank Solution, Ellen Brown's groundbreaking work began the movement to create new American public banks. We'll look at issues surrounding the world of money and the systems and powers that control it, as well as the progress being made on the public banking frontier. The program is underwritten by Public Banking Associates, a national consultancy of experts advising government leaders pursuing creation of their own public banks at publicbankingassociates.com.
Punchline to all of this is that state legislature, the governor, have signed off on a form of publicly owned banks. This is the first time this has happened in 100 years, and it's going to open the door for a lot of new structures for cities to consider when making investments locally. That could mean everything from divesting from Wall Street with their current checking and cash management needs and borrowing needs, but also just the application of new loan structures through public banks. There's a lot of options that are opened up, even with the limited use cases that this law provides for.
That's David Jetty, one of the key leaders of the large troop of stalwart California activists who have won the first statewide legislative battle to create new publicly owned municipal banks, an exciting and important breakthrough for public banking interests nationwide. We'll be hearing from David and others in a few minutes here on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Hello and welcome. I'm Walt McCree, Ellen's co-host and senior advisor to the Public Banking Institute. Today, we're going to luxuriate just a bit in the pivotal California win created by California Governor Gavin Newsom's recent signature on Bill 857, which sets the stage for creation of municipal and county banks across that state, which, it should be noted, is also the fifth largest economy in the world. We'll also hear from one of the citizens who helped get that movement started a few years ago out of the disaster that was befalling homeowners illegally forced out of their homes by the big banks after they collapsed in 2008 and their scandals started to take control of private assets. Carlos Marroquin was propelled into that public banking effort by that outrage, which also claimed his home. And Ellen's featured guest interview today is with Tom Greco, a global expert and author on monetary systems, who will shed a broader light on why things like the 2008 bank collapse occurs at all on a regular basis. Thomas Greco will delve into the private debt-based banking regime that has been exposed by insiders for decades. Here's a short excerpt from their conversation.
The powers of financial capitalism had another far-reaching aim, nothing less than to create a world system of financial control in private hands able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole. The system was to be controlled in a feudalist fashion by the central banks of the world, acting in concert by secret agreements arrived at in frequent private meetings and conferences. And basically, this is the way it has been.
With that as documented historical context, you can see why the folks in California are excited about moving toward public control of public dollars. So let's get started and talk with Ellen about these developments.
Well, Ellen, our last show, we had some potentially really good news about a Bill 857 in California that had been passed. And now we have a governor's signature on it, so we have a breakthrough in the prospects for public banking in the nation. Pretty exciting stuff, right?
Yeah. So the governor signed it, and one provision of the bill is that we can only have two new banks per year for 7 years, and then they're going to reassess, see where we are, see how the banks have worked out, and then theoretically they'll charter some more. So everybody is all excited, and they're all competing already to be the first city or county or collection of counties to be the first one or two or three to get chartered. in L.A. Of course, L.A. is a city of 4 million people, and they've already worked on this a couple of years. So they're anticipating being first, and San Francisco is liable to be the other first, or Oakland. Oakland's also been working on this for a couple of years. So it's not just Oakland. It's Oakland in combination with some other cities in that area. So anyway, probably the best thing that came out of this bill is that, first of all, it showed that we, the people, can beat Wall Street just on the ground. Like, there were no paid lobbyists, no money behind it at all. It was just all volunteers and all people power, and they had some significant opposition, you know, from big Wall Street lobbyists, and they still right. managed to win. Yeah, so that was great.
Yeah, that's very exciting, and certainly part of the national impact that this California experience is that the people are really starting to take control of a central piece of public policy, basically who gets to hold and deal with our money. So the impact in other states is being felt in a lot of different ways. I mean, I know that both of us are seeing all kinds of communications from legislators and others who say, hey, how does this work? So it's an exciting time. We're going to be talking to David Jetty, who was one of the principal movers of the California movement. And so let's go do that now and hear what David has to say about the experience of moving Bill 857 into reality, both for California and for the USA.
Okay. Hi, David. It's great to be talking to you. You were one of the prime movers and shakers in California's landmark win with its public banking bill, AB 857. So first, let me say hearty congratulations to you and the whole team. We are all very excited about it. Can you describe the bill from your perspective and tell us exactly what it was that was won?
Sure, and I have to give the congratulations right back to you, Ellen. You're the mother of this movement, and none of it would be possible without you and the effort you and your compatriots have put in over decades. We've just taken the baton and run with it, so thanks for that.
Well, your energy has done it. I mean, I'm so impressed with your whole millennial group. I don't know if you're, I guess you're a millennial.
Well, we're definitely in this millennium, and we think we're going to found the first public bank in the United States in this millennium in short order. AB 857 lets us do that. The bill itself defines a public bank as a financial institution founded and owned entirely by public entities, either a single city or county, or a joint powers authority between cities and counties.
Mm-hmm.
It establishes those banks as essentially commercial banks with many of, if not the same or more, rules on their operation. It requires deposit insurance and establishes that these banks must hold public deposits in the same way as other commercial banks, which, you know, we can get into a little bit. And it also requires that these banks have a social purpose defined at their founding, which they must be accountable for. It also sets requirements for the democratic approval of applications for these bank charters. So politicians mm-hmm. can't just spin these up on their own. They do have to go to their legislatures, and in some cases to voters, to approve their applications prior to them being considered by the DBO. But the punchline to all of this is that the state legislature, the governor, have signed off on a form of publicly owned banks. This is the first time this has happened in 100 years, and it's going to open the door for a lot of new structures for cities to consider when making investments locally. That could mean everything from divesting from Wall Street with their current checking and cash management needs and borrowing needs, but also just the application of new loan structures through public banks, possibly through credit unions and community banks, possibly through utilities. There's a lot of options that are opened up, even with the limited use cases that this law provides for.
You mentioned something about a different depository structure. Do you want to go into that?
Well, these banks are not permitted to fractionally lend on public deposits, right? In that they are subject to the same collateral requirements that private banks are when holding public deposits, which in California, for most collateral requires 110% of the balance of deposits. So if a city were to put $100 million into a public bank, that bank would actually need to hold $110 million worth of qualified assets, either cash or cash equivalents, like letters from Federal Home Loan Bank. They'd have to be able to point to those assets that can be recovered in the case of bank insolvency to protect the public's money. Now, you and I know that this is kind of absurd because the public owns that bank. Why would the public make a run on that bank? And furthermore, why would that bank be unsafe in any way to the public, which owns it and is also making those deposits? But we cannot do it all at once. And county treasurers and city treasurers are very well within their duties to be skeptical of new financial structures that might put public deposits at risk. So we have to take this step by step in the state process. You know, we pushed hard to try and get this piece of public banking into the consciousness of the legislators. Yeah, but we do have to take it step by step. So in the short term, public deposits will not be as leverageable as we want them to be. But that doesn't mean that they can't serve. Public banks can't serve as alternative depositories, so that cities can divest from Wall Street. And it doesn't mean that these banks aren't going to be able to make loans. It's just going to have to be a little more creative.
Yeah. Well, and I think a letter of credit for standby letter of credit from the Federal Home Loan Banks is supposedly cheap. I wasn't able to find out exactly what they cost, but it's not like you have to post the full sum of your deposits. You just need this guarantee, assuming that's acceptable by the DBO, the Department of Business Oversight.
That's right. And of course, then you get into the game of interest rate arbitrage, which is, you know, most of what banking is. But you know, we want to be careful, you know, to not just be another layer on the stack, generating unproductive profits on behalf of anyone, the public or otherwise. So obviously the promise of public banking is to reduce that interest arbitrage stack for the public. But if we can, in the short term, partner with federal agencies or other kinds of debt instruments that can provide that collateral, then we should be able to collateralize public deposits and make loans profitably for the public bank, but still mm-hmm. below market rates for social good.
I know of one requirement that everybody was concerned about that got waived, which was that this strange provision in the state law that says counties shall not lend their credit to corporations and individuals, which was construed to mean they couldn't have a bank. So AB 857 specifically says that there's an exception for public banks, so that doesn't apply to a county public bank. So that was good. Are there other things that got set aside, that issues, that hurdles, in other words, to establishing a bank that the bill set aside?
Simply the acknowledgement of public banks in law clears a lot of uncertainty for cities and counties that were looking into these things. Right? Mm-hmm. It was unclear what kind of category these banks would fall into. Now there can be no category error. And as a result, the regulators will be able to look at these not as novel concepts, but within a bucket they already know how to put things in. And that's very important when you're dealing with regulators. You don't want to have a lot of interpretation for them. Now, is there still a lot of regulatory discretion in these banks? Yes. In fact, not just at the state level, but the FDIC has also acknowledged that any kind of public bank is going to receive special scrutiny when applying for, let's say, deposit insurance, which these banks are required to have. So there's still uncertainty, but now it's in the hands of regulators instead of a sort of a political question of whether this is worth it. So this bill establishes that these banks will be tax-free. That was a fight that we had to win in the process of legislating this, because, you know, banks, commercial banks pay taxes, theoretically, on parts of their business. Credit unions do not. And we, of course, think that we're very much in league with the credit unions in this regard, because this is a bank owned by its depositors, right? So obviously it's a government institution. But there was the anti-competitive argument against these banks kind of being able to operate outside of taxes and possibly lowering tax revenues. But, you know, we all know that banks don't get taxed on what they make, not really, that certainly not by local institutions or local jurisdictions. So wasn't really a good faith argument, but we did win that one.
Yeah, that's great. I know you had an uphill battle against some big, high-powered, high-paid lobbyists. So what other battles did you engage in and win?
Well, you know, there were lots of poison pills along the way, requirements for referendums for all banks, right? We were able to limit that to banks which are simply county banks, which may need additional sort of democratic input before forming banks, but that charter cities, of course, are free to do what they need to do to maintain their home rule. So we did fend that off. We were able to get around certain unconstitutional poison pills that were attempted to be added late in the game, and we were able to neutralize credit unions who were at first against this bill, but moved neutral after we, you know, really engaged with them and said, listen, we want our public banks to support forms of financing that are non-extractive, that are locally focused, that are not just sending profits to Manhattan. And, you know, that means that these banks are going to work through credit unions. They're going to work through local banks to expand lending capacity at those banks, to offer new products to consumers that may have been too expensive for those banks to offer in the past, but with a larger scale partner that has social good in its mission, we can maybe push that over the line, provide more free checking services to people who are currently unbanked or underbanked, provide new student loan programs or, let's say, energy retrofit programs for homes, and try and bring down the carbon footprint of our city. These kinds of programs can blossom with this partner. And, you know, I think that in the end, they were probably mainly moved by the restrictions we put on public banks, since this was a legislative process. But it's a good jumping off point for us to discuss working with those folks, with those existing institutions, nonprofits, to deploy public banking at scale.
Yeah, I just saw an article today on City Council President Herb Wesson's press conference where, you know, of course they have to give the pros and the cons, so they were citing some banker who said, we would be competing with the local banks that are already serving, you know, these underserved communities, which they obviously just don't get it, what we're talking about here. We're not competing. So that's specifically in the bill, that the bank wouldn't be competing with local banks, but would be partnering with them, just as the Bank of North Dakota does. And it said that in their original charter of 100 years ago. So that is the public banking model. So I think that's one good thing is, like you say, you're just out there pushing, and getting more information out there. And you've managed to get 180 organizations to sign on to the bill and generated a whole lot of excitement. So that's really super.
Yeah, it's very exciting, and it does. It's a lot of people coming together, a lot of effort, a lot of lucky things going our way as well. You know, you can't discount the fact that there are not a lot of legislators in California. When you think about how many bills must be considered, the opinion of a single legislator is so much. It's so powerful. So, you know, whether they like this bill or not, you know, any individual four or five Democrats in a particular committee is a crapshoot sometimes. So I consider us both lucky and fortunate to have had the authors that we did, to have the allies that we did, and the support of all of those organizations and the incredible volunteers that put in all their time. You know, I'm on your show talking, but the fact is most of the work was done by folks working on this bill, calling and wrangling legislators and fending off arguments from lobbyists. You know, those are folks like Sushil Jacob and Sylvia Chi, obviously Trinity Tran, Susan Harmon. There's so many people in this movement who put in so many hours. And that's the only way that you can have a victory for grassroots movements is if people apply themselves and get lucky and fend off the temptation to, well, dang, let's just go raise some money. This would be a lot easier if we were getting paid. Well, the problem with that is that you then have a master, and you can't serve two. If the master is the people, then you will be divided. So, you know, here in the short term in LA, we are lucky that we have a city government and Herb Wesson and other folks who are in the city council who support this idea, but we cannot rely on them to do it the right way. We have to remain engaged. We have to remain independent of the influence of real estate developers, of banks, and of even elected officials, and demand that these banks are accountable to the people and that they solve real problems for those people as soon as they can. We have to be measured, and we have to be engaged.
And also, I forget who said it, but at that press conference, it was said that when a group, it's very rare to have a group of voters to show up who are unpaid, whereas usually it's the lobbyists who appear in the offices of the legislators. So it's just very impressive to have these very committed young people trooping around from, and not all young either. Like,
oh, no, it's folks from all generations. Yeah, all backgrounds. And it's always funny when you're walking around State House and you see the one guy from the American Bankers Association leaving the office, and then in come 20 or 25 activists from all over the state saying, hey, like, we actually know the voters. So, yeah, like, you may get a mean letter from the Chamber of Commerce if you vote for this, but you're going to hear from a lot more people if you don't. So that's people power. That's how it works. And in stuff like this, state issues that are kind of wonky, you can have a lot of impact. You know, it's harder on the big controversial gigantic spending bills or, you know, your big referendums. There's millions and millions of dollars being spent to win those. And sometimes it seems really hard to win those. But these smaller victories are sometimes more attainable, and they're very satisfying. I got to say, it's a good feeling.
Yeah, that's great. And that is the good of working with your local city legislators, too, is you can form a personal relationship with them, actually get to know them. All right. Well, you all have done super work. Is there anything else you'd like to close with?
Well, the city of L.A. is going to be looking for qualified folks who can lead the bank, the city's banking efforts in the short term and come up with a proposal and business plan. And, you know, if you live in Los Angeles, you need to stay engaged with this process. The more behind closed doors it is, the harder it will be to keep these folks accountable to making a bank that works for everyone. So, you know, we fully intend to remain engaged there, and we definitely want your support. There are going to be efforts in San Francisco and East Bay, which are ongoing, obviously. And, they're farther along than we are. And if you live in those cities, join their efforts, too. And if you're in Santa Rosa, if you're in San Diego, if you're in San Jose and South Bay, there's public banking groups all over California that are a part of the California Public Banking Alliance. We're critical to the passing of this bill, and now we're going to take that baton locally and found those banks. If you want to be a part of that, you need to join up now. Go to californiapublicbankingalliance.org, I think, and you can find information on your local group. If there isn't one, start one.
Right. That's great. And if you're not in California, go to publicbankinginstitute.org. And we've also got advocates all over the country working on these bills. All right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks so much, David. And thanks for all your work. And thanks for taking time for an interview.
Thanks, Ellen.
Now, I'd like you to hear a few thoughts from one of the citizens on the ground in California who helped to start this effort years ago. Carlos Marroquin has been a tireless and spirited advocate for public banking because he was one of the tens of thousands of people who lost their homes to illegal foreclosure. He's one of the growing number of voices calling for a new democratic power in banking.
For me, you know, this has been quite an experience and quite a, I would say, honored to be part of something like this, because, you know, any time that we do something that will affect people, that's what I thrive on. That's what I look for. I would like to get involved in issues that will affect the people in a positive way. Public banking does that. And for me, it has been several years since I've been at this. I actually started the big push for public banking here in Southern California, or in California, back in the days of Occupy, when the home Wall Street, the big banks, were doing massive fraud upon the people. That's where I began to engage the idea of public banking in a more serious way to bring awareness to people. I know it was going to be tough because a lot of people, most of the people still don't know what a public banking is and what it does. So the challenge was set before us right from the beginning. But one thing that we have is that we had a banking institutions that continue to exhibit their fraudulent practices. They haven't stopped since the foreclosure crisis. They never stopped, you know, defrauding the people and taking advantage and abusing members of their banking institution. Those that use private banks have been, you know, targeted by them to take as much as they can from the people. So, yeah, it has been great for me. Right now, I am very excited because we were able to accomplish something that I had not been able to accomplish in 100 years. And the possibilities are enormous. You know, the sky is the limit, as they would say. And you all really rest on how much do we want to go with this? How far do we want to take this? How much do we want to spread it to other states as well, you know? We need to form a national campaign so that all the states will jump on this. I am fully aware that there are already some states that are looking into public banking, but why not the 50 states? You know, this calls for a 50-state campaign. The momentum is ours right now. We got some wins behind us. People are pretty much discontent with the way Wall Street has been behaving, even after all the massive fraud they committed. So people are fed up. I think that people are looking for options, and this is a great option. And we have a long ways to go because we would like to see, you know, more public banking in the form where people will be able to do even transactions, you know, personal transactions within a public bank, whatever that may look like. We leave that to the experts. But, you know, we got to take as much as we got to be able to provide. Let me say it like that better. We got to be able to come out and provide better options for the people, for our cities, for our communities.
That was Carlos Marroquin of Los Angeles, a member of the California Public Banking Alliance.
It's my pleasure to be speaking with Thomas Greco, a writer and lecturer who is regarded as one of the leading experts in monetary theory and history, in credit clearing systems, and in complementary currencies. Tom has written many articles and 4 books, the most recent of which is The End of Money and the Future of Civilization. He is also a former professor of business and has traveled all over the world, lecturing, teaching, and advising. Tom, it's great to be talking to you.
Thank you, Ellen. It's great to be with you.
So, you've written extensively on the dysfunctional nature of our conventional money and banking system and how a more ideal money system could be structured. You're very good at outlining the problem, so I thought I'd start with that. Where has our money system gone wrong, and why is there never enough money to go around?
The fundamental flaw in the monetary system as it exists today is the fact that money is created when banks make loans, and they charge interest on those loans. And with the passage of time, the size of the debt increases automatically because of the compound interest that's built into it. So you have a continual explosion of debt, an exponential explosion of debt, which is necessary for the system to continue. If the debt were not continually increased, there would necessarily be numerous defaults on existing debts, or the money supply would shrink, and the economy would collapse. This is sort of what happened during the Great Depression of the 1930s. There was a dearth of official money in circulation. When the private sector gets all loaned up, so to speak, that is, when it cannot take on any additional debt, then the government steps in to become the borrower of last resort. And we've seen this happen over and over again. Now, in business school, they taught us that the business cycle was sort of something that was just an automatic part of the system. It was just there. It's like a natural phenomenon. But it's not a natural phenomenon. It's an artifact of the interest-based debt money system. So the other parts of the system that are dysfunctional and causing tremendous difficulties is the fact that banking is centralized. There is a banking cartel that is supported by the government that enables a few to prosper at the expense of the many. So we've seen, especially in the last 40 years, a continual increase in the concentration of wealth and power in the hands of few. And it's very well documented that the differences between the various income and wealth classes are becoming ever greater. So when the Occupy movement talks about the 1%, actually they should be talking about the 0.1%, because this is the upper echelon of the economic and power pyramid. And those who control money control everything else, including the politics. So these are some of the things that we need to get around. My proposal has always been that we need to devolve power toward communities and toward the people in general. And the way to do that is to reinvent money and banking.
Yeah, well, I want to get into that, but going back to what's wrong with the system, I totally agree about the whole interest problem, and I've been beating that horse for years. But, you know, I always get pushback from people who say, well, you can pay it because of the velocity of money. In other words, say, for example, you're the lender. You make a $1,000 loan to the borrower at 20%, payable at $100 a month for a year. So in a year, the whole loan plus interest is paid off. So every month you hire the borrower to scrub your floors, and you pay him $100 for that. So every month you're paying him basically what he, I mean, the argument is that because the loans are paid back over time, you can recirculate that money and get it to, I mean, I'd love to have a good response to that. My response is that, okay, fine, but first of all, the banker doesn't hire the borrowers. I mean, it's true. In a public banking system, that is pretty much what would happen. You would recirculate the money into the local economy. And so maybe arguably there, you know, you could overcome the interest problem. But in the real world, the bankers don't hire their borrowers. The borrowers are probably out of work, or they're certainly not getting paid enough to pay off their loans and still have money left over for all the things they want to do, et cetera. And we've got other drains on the system, like the fact that even if there were no interest, people don't spend all their money back into the system. And because it's all an advance in the first place, you know, borrowed money that has to be paid back. If it's not all paid back, if some of it goes under mattresses, then there's not enough money in the system. So what do you say to all that?
Yeah, well, I agree with you. It's the bankers don't spend all the money that comes to them in the form of interest. The interest, basically, whether it's in the bank, in the hands of the bankers, or in the secondary market where capitalists lend out their surplus, that money does not get spent. It gets invested. So you have a continual search for investment opportunities. And a lot of that comes from privatizing the commons. You have rent seekers everywhere trying to take control of the commons and charge those who use the commons for access. But your arguments are correct. I think this idea about the velocity of money and the ability for the debt to be repaid is nonsense, and I haven't ever seen the logic of that. So I think the burden is upon those who make that argument to show how it actually works. But as you point out, the bankers don't hire the people that scrub the floors. That's in the secondary market. So I don't think we need to spend a lot of time on this.
We know for a fact that debt always grows faster than the money available to repay it. So how do you explain that?
The empirical evidence is plain. You know, debt keeps increasing in both the public and the private sector, and it's increasing without end. That's the only way to keep the system going, and that's why I say the government must step in as the borrower of last resort. If the private sector can't borrow, then the government must borrow to keep the money supply pumped up. And the question is, what are the limits to that? When do we reach the limit?
Which we seem to be. It certainly looks like we're pushing the limits right now. And you prefer decentralization, I know, and you're a big advocate of community currencies or mutual credit clearing systems. Do you want to explain what a mutual credit clearing system is and how it works? I mean, I think most people are familiar with community currencies, but like as a piece of paper that some community prints. But nowadays we have trade clearing systems that don't use paper at all. They're just digital, right? So do you want to explain that?
Yeah, well, what we're talking about is credit. You have, I make the distinction, and this isn't original, between exchange credit, what used to be called turnover credit, and investment credit. Turnover credit, or exchange credit, is short term. It's the credit that's given to producers in order to enable them to produce. That is credit that they use to pay their suppliers and their employees for all of the inputs that go into the production. And then this money that's created on the basis of production that's going to market becomes the means of exchange for people to take those goods and services off the market. So you can say that money, if it's properly created on the basis of goods and services coming to market, is a representation of the value of those goods and services, and that enables those goods and services to be purchased. So on the other side, you've got investment credit. Investment credit is basically savings. Savings and investment are two sides of the same coin. It's surplus that people have that they want to put aside to be able to access later on when their earning capacity is diminished or non-existent. For example, when people retire from gainful employment or when they're disabled. So this is a whole subject that needs a thorough discussion. The distinction between the exchange function and the savings / investment function. And I did some of that in my first book, which was called Money and Debt, A Solution to the Global Crisis. But, you know, you have to look at how do we save in a modern economy? We save by obtaining a claim against someone who is going to provide us with what we need in the future. And there are various kinds of claims. There's debt claims and equity claims, like shares in a corporate stock. So we have to make that distinction between short-term exchange credit and long-term investment credit, which is the way we save. When we talk about mutual credit clearing, what we're talking about is taking the power to allocate credit away from banks and using it directly ourselves. The way I put it is, in today's system, we give our credit to the banks and allow them to lend it back to us and charge us interest for the privilege. Now, when banks do business amongst themselves, let's say I pay you with a check drawn on my credit union here in Tucson. You take that check and you deposit it in your credit union or bank, wherever you happen to live. And now my bank owes your bank because they have given you cash or a deposit based on my check. And the banks have a clearinghouse. In the old days, every local community had a clearinghouse where the banks would take the checks at the end of each day, and they would sort them out and determine which bank owed which other banks how much. And there might be millions of dollars worth of checks, but they would net these out amongst themselves and then settle the accounts with a payment, which would be much smaller amount than the total transactions that they were clearing. Well, if banks can clear credits amongst themselves, producers can clear credits amongst themselves directly without having the need for using bank money or borrowing from a bank. We can finance producer credit through direct credit clearing associations. So we have multiple associations like this currently in operation. They're called commercial trade exchanges, incorrectly called barter exchanges. And basically, they have a membership consisting of businesses who buy and sell amongst themselves, and they simply keep a ledger of accounts. They don't use money to make these payments. They simply pay each other with their own internal credits. So let's say that you're a restaurateur and you're a member of a trade exchange. You join the trade exchange and you're given a line of credit based on your capacity to provide meals to the community. So now you can go ahead and spend. Let's say I'm an accountant. You hire me to keep your books. So now you pay me with the credits that you draw from your line of credit. So now your line of credit gets reduced. Your account gets debited for the amount that you pay me, and my account gets credited for the price that I charge you for my services.
Is there no interest on the line of credit?
No, typically there is no interest on these lines of credit. Trade credit should be interest-free. And this is simply an extension of current business practice. When businesses trade with one another, it's typically on open account. I will buy something, let's say, from a manufacturer. Let's say I'm a computer shop. I buy a bunch of computers from the manufacturer, and they send me an invoice, and they give me 30 days or 60 days or some other time period to pay. So basically, they're giving me an interest-free line of credit. What we're doing with a mutual credit clearing exchange is we're doing this on a multilateral basis instead of a bilateral basis. So the manager of the exchange makes an assessment as to the credit limits that each member business can maintain and allocates credit on that basis. So the credit clearing algorithm is an important part of a mutual credit system, where each business is evaluated according to its capacity to provide value to the community. And on that basis, we've created basically an internal money supply.
Are there fees for that, for managing all that?
Yes, of course. This is a business that must have adequate revenues to pay for its expenses of providing the services. Now, commercial trade exchanges typically provide services on the basis of payments either in cash or in trade credit. And one of my chapters in The End of Money and the Future of Civilization goes into detail about how these mutual credit clearing exchanges work and what are the limitations of the current practice in the trade exchange industry. So when I outline those limitations, I also provide some recommendations. Basically, the trade exchange industry is limited by the scale and scope of its operations.
It should be a major limitation on all community currencies. There are just not enough products available to make, locally.
The answer is to network these small local trade exchanges together, and this is being done already to some extent with something called universal currency. It's a inter-exchange currency that's been instituted by the International Reciprocal Trade Association, and the volume of trades between exchanges has been growing. It's sort of the way the local trade exchanges clear obligations amongst themselves when their members want to trade across exchange lines. So this is growing, and it needs to be improved upon. I can foresee in the future, this is my grand vision, for small, relatively local mutual credit clearing exchanges in the millions scattered around the world and all networked together into an internet of exchange where my trade credits and my local trade exchange can be allocated to me locally based on my ability to provide goods and services and my reputation for good service and all of that. But I can use my credits globally to get what I need when I'm outside my local region. Just like when I travel to England or Malaysia or Thailand, I can use my credits and my local credit union to get the British pounds or the euros or the ringgits that I need in the place that I happen to be. So we can replicate many of the advantages of the existing system without having the disadvantages of that system.
My vision is to nationalize Amazon, and we could all like sell into it for credits, and or eBay, you know, nationalize eBay. We could all sell into it and use our credits to buy other things.
I can go along with that. I think that Amazon and Facebook and all of these other huge platform businesses are public utilities, and they ought to be publicly owned and accountable.
I agree. They would have a fit, you know. I mean, it'd be a big lawsuit, I'm sure. But one thing that could happen would be for the central bank to just buy their stock, and it's a done deal. Switzerland buys stock, and the Bank of Japan buys, the Swiss central bank buys stock, and the Bank of Japan buys exchange traded funds.
Yeah, well, this is one part of the quantitative easing that has become the vogue since the 2008 banking crisis, and this is the way that they basically saved the system from collapse by the central bank.
Well, it seems to me that quantitative easing and all the other outrageous things they've done has just shown us what can be done. There was all this outrage like it would cause hyperinflation. That didn't happen. Of course, we know why. It didn't even go into the real...
Well, we had to explore that. Why didn't it cause inflation?
Because it didn't inflate the consumer market, because it didn't go into the consumer market. Yeah.
Exactly. It went into the hands of the already rich, and it went into inflation of asset prices rather than inflation of consumer goods. But, you know, despite what the government says, we've had considerable amounts of inflation in consumer good prices as well.
Certainly in housing, but I think they exclude that from consumer goods, mm-hmm. which it's
well,
not.
They play games with consumer price index, so it doesn't show up in the consumer price index. But there are shadow stats that show the real consumer price index, and you can find those online.
Yeah. Well, anyway, and they bought stock, and there are different things that we now know a central bank could do. It seems to me because there is this gap between the available money supply and the debt, you always need more money out there, which Michael Hudson has written, you know, extensively about how in ancient Mesopotamia they maintained a system with 33% interest for 2,000 years without booms and busts, and the way they did it was with the periodic debt jubilees. But so what we could do is periodic pumping of extra money into the system, but into the actual economy, not, you know, the real economy, the productive economy and the consumer economy. You could do a universal basic income. You could buy up things like Amazon. I know there's a proposal out there to buy up the oil companies, because otherwise we'll never get them to do what we want. All those things might be controversial, but the thing is, we now know that the tools are there. They've demonstrated what they can do. So,
the key point that you made there, and that Michael Hudson talks about in his book, is the debt forgiveness, the jubilee. And the jubilee is way overdue in the modern economy. Debt forgiveness is something that needs to be done when you have interest in the system, because you always end up with a situation where some of the debtors are not going to be able to pay. This is automatic in a system that employs interest.
You said that local public banks could be good, but you're opposed to central banks, at least in their current form. I'd say we need central banks too, so we can, you know, get this extra money into the system, but that they need to be nationalized so that they serve as public utilities. But anyway, you are a great historian of banking and money, so I just wondered if you could go into the shady history of our central banking system. I know you've quoted Carol Quigley and others, so if you could remind us of where it's come from and why we want to be alerted.
Yeah, sure. Carol Quigley was a professor at Georgetown University, and he taught many notable people in government, including Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton praised Quigley in his acceptance speech when he was nominated for president in 1992. And Quigley wrote a book called Tragedy and Hope. This was published in 1966. And Quigley was an insider. I mean, he had access to all of the information of the elite power brokers. And he said in his book, the powers of financial capitalism had another far-reaching aim, nothing less than to create a world system of financial control in private hands, able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole. The system was to be controlled in a feudalist fashion by the central banks of the world, acting in concert by secret agreements arrived at in frequent private meetings and conferences. And basically, this is the way it has been. We have the Bank for International Settlements, we have the International Monetary Fund, we have the World Bank. These are all aspects of this global monetary regime. And the central banks do work in concert, as we have seen. When inflation gets too high in one country, they will shift it over to another country by their central bank doing what needs to be done, or by manipulating foreign exchange rates between the currencies. In my opinion, given this solid control by the banking and financial elite over not only economics and finance, but also over politics worldwide, you know, I say whoever controls money controls everything else. I don't see that there's much chance of reform. I don't see that a centralized system, no matter who has nominal ownership of it, is going to really solve the problem. My approach is to find ways to devolve power to the communities and to the people themselves. And if we believe in democracy, that's basically what democracy it is, where people have control. And representative democracy, I think, is an oxymoron. If it's representative, it's basically elite control. It's not democracy. So yeah. The only way that I can see forward in devolving power, political power, is to devolve economic power to communities and people. And the way we do that is to take control of credit. And we do this by establishing mutual credit clearing exchanges and private community currencies that do not depend on banks, that do not require government money or central bank-created money. The problem with most of the local currencies that we're familiar with that have been tried over the last 30 years is that most of them are sold for cash. You have to have government money to bring them into existence. So you've got Toronto dollars and Berkshires in the United States, and you've got Bristol pounds and Brixton pounds and Lewes pounds and any number of other local pounds in the UK. They all follow this model of selling the currency into existence for political money. And this really doesn't do much except act as a gift certificate or gift card. You know, when you go to Target and you buy a gift card, that's basically the same thing as a local currency that's sold for cash. But they do it even better because they don't allow the gift card to be redeemed back into cash. You have to use it to buy merchandise or services from the issuing business. But these local currencies that are sold for cash, they typically allow it to be redeemed back into cash. So it might change hands once or twice before it gets redeemed back into cash and doesn't accomplish very much.
One other topic that you expressed interest in, I had written an article about Mark Carney's saying that we've run out of ammunition. I mean, several big central bankers are now saying they're out of ammunition and they've got to do things differently. Mark Carney said we needed to change the game, and his proposal was basically he wants to get rid of the dollar as reserve currency. globally and have a central bank issued reserve currency instead. And you responded, you thought instead of a game changer, what they really wanted was more power. So, I mean, that's basically what I was saying, too. But do you want to go into that a little bit, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, I can agree with him that we certainly need to change what we're doing. We need to change the game. He and I agree on that, and you do, too. But what's the new game? That's the question.
Right.
And I think their new game is just more concentration of power and wealth and centralization of control. Instead of the dollar as the global reserve currency, they want to create another reserve currency under the control of a global central bank. And this reserve currency will simply be a further consolidation of power. I mean, the IMF has already proposed this kind of thing. And there's plenty of documentation out there as to the direction they want to go. It doesn't devolve power. It concentrates power further into the hands of corporate and banking elite. You know, we've seen governments being disempowered to a considerable extent over the period of time, from especially the 1980s. But that power is being migrated upward to corporate entities. And these corporate entities are no longer national entities, they're global entities. The laws are such that a company can incorporate in the United States or some other country and do business anywhere in the world, and their charter is respected. There should be limitations on corporate charters. You know, once we grant limited liability to an artificial person that we call a corporation, that entity ought to pay back to the general community the value of that privilege. And this is something that Andrew Jackson said way back in 1832 when he vetoed the recharter bill for the Second Bank of the United States. That was one of the things that he pointed out, that when government grants a privilege or an exclusive monopoly, the people ought to be compensated for that. There is a social cost to the corporate charter. And what the banking elite want to do is they simply want to accelerate and maximize the shift of power from national governments to the global corporate elite. And that's what their plan for a global central bank and a new global reserve currency will do. What I want to do is to decentralize the control of credit to empower people, to migrate power away from central governments downward to communities and the people at large.
I totally agree. We don't want an international currency that's issued by a cartel of central banks, which would remove it one step even further. I mean, right now, theoretically, at least, we have some control over our central banks in that Congress could repeal the Federal Reserve Act or amend it, which they do routinely. But we would have no control over this central bank organization.
Nominally, the government has control of the central bank, but in actuality, the other way around, the central bankers control the government. Not the central bankers per se, but the bankers that control the central bankers.
Well, it's been great talking to you.
Thank you, Ellen. I appreciate your giving me the opportunity to address your listeners. They can find more information about my work, my books, my articles, my interviews and presentations on my website. It's beyondmoney.net, beyondmoney.net. And we also have a podcast that's available through that site. Thanks again for having me on.
Okay, thanks for talking to you. It's always great to hear your views.
And likewise yours.
Thanks. I've been speaking with Thomas Greco, a writer and lecturer in monetary theory and history and complementary currencies, and has written several books, including The End of Money and the Future of Civilization.
Well, that's it for this edition of It's Our Money with Ellen Brown. Our thanks to our guests, our sponsor, Public Banking Associates, and to you for listening. Be sure to check out Ellen's latest writings on the economy and the changing world of money by visiting ellenbrown.com. And for more information on public banking, visit publicbankinginstitute.org. For information on how local and state government leaders can obtain professional insight and counsel about public banks from key national experts, visit publicbankingassociates.com. I'm Walt McCree. See you next time on It's Our Money with Ellen Brown.